This week on Life and Faith.
I really do believe in collective leadership. I've always believed my opinions are improved, advanced by listening to others. And it would get criticised sometimes by people in the press who would say, oh, you know, he's indecisive. Where's the indecision? What they're complaining about is you didn't make a spur of the moment decision, you know, make every decision from the flying from the seat of your pants. You know, the person that thinks they know everything or have got the instant answer. And of course, in politics, there is a real tendency to be looking for the decision that gives you the media hit. You know, it gives you literally 5 minutes of sunshine. Then all of the problems and follow-up and implementation, etc., descend on you.
We have entered into an amusing ourselves to death moment in history.
It doesn't make sense to me. If there is God, God's supposed to be free.
I was 100% sure that I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for happiness in this world.
Miracles don't necessarily change anybody's mind. It just gets their attention.
And so I had to run with my child on my back, the ISA army coming behind us.
I said, gee, Uncle George, this is luxurious for a communist. Son, he said, nothing's too good for the worker. Nothing.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Well, Malcolm Turnbull was the 29th Prime Minister of Australia, and he held that position for 3 years before famously being toppled by his own party. He recently released his autobiography, A Bigger Picture, which recounts what has been a fascinating life, not only in politics. Malcolm Turnbull is well known as a successful journalist, lawyer, and merchant banker before he turned to politics. He grew up the son of a single dad in Sydney's eastern suburbs and had a colourful career defending spycatcher Peter Wright against the British government and acting as Kerry Packer's lawyer and leading the Republican movement. All of this makes for a riveting book that's much more than a political memoir. Malcolm Turnbull spoke to me and Tim Costello about the book, his life, politics and religion in Australia, and what might lie ahead for him.
So, Malcolm, congratulations on the book. Any memoir is about the public persona and public record and people who like Malcolm and think they know him or don't like Malcolm. It's certainly a record of personal life, marriage and family background of the author. But in a bigger picture, you have been very vulnerable. Often the private person is withheld. And you've been very expansive about private areas, depression, suicidality. Was it a difficult decision to go beyond public and personal to private and include this?
It was certainly a difficult chapter to write, but I think it was important to do so. I think it helps people, a lot of people who are battling with mental illness, to know that others have had that struggle and got through it. And so that's certainly the feedback I've had. But to be honest, Tim, one of the things that made it so important that I deal with it was when I came across these diaries that I'd made at the time. You know, they were just so powerful, so dark, so real, and so in the moment that when I came across these diaries that I'd lost, literally, I thought, well, I should include some of this because it had so much meaning for me and significance for me, but I knew that others would find it very meaningful as well. And that's certainly been the experience.
And have you found, it's early days for feedback, that being so vulnerable has actually elicited response that has surprised you to the book?
Not really. I mean, the responses to the book have been more favourable than I expected, to be honest, but if you're in public life, you know, they say you get brickbats and bouquets. Well, you know, there are not too many bouquets. So, no, it's been, the predictable, most of the criticism in the Murdoch press in particular, you could have written before the book was published, right? They wouldn't, it was ready to go.
Can I ask you about the experience of sitting down to write about your life? I think that's a really interesting thing. I mean, you've both done it, but I'm just thinking about the motivation that we have, many of us, to tell our story. What do you think's behind that? I find that interesting.
Well, I think it's absolutely innate. It's human. There are some things that are very naturally human, and we're social animals and we're storytelling animals. And we hundreds of thousands of years ago anyway, you know, doing pictures on cave walls, it's the same. It's an instinct. And I think it's a good one. You know, I think ultimately it's very important to know, to understand your own story and to be able to reflect on it and to understand our story, our collective story. You know, when Edmund Burke said, we're a sort of a partnership between civilization or society, he said, was a partnership between the living, the dead, and those, the generation yet to be born. It's a very powerful point because, you know, otherwise, as he said, we would just be like the flies of the summer, you know, that come into existence not knowing that there's ever been a fly before and then die not knowing there'll ever be a fly again, you know.
You've had a wonderful marriage and family life. You've been enormously successful, Malcolm, in business, in your professional life, but by your own description, made a late entry into politics, made it to the top political office, and then rather viciously torn down by colleagues, which you detail in the book. Do you have any regrets about a late entry into politics? Any lasting scars?
Well, I don't. Well, I'm sure there are lasting scars, but not in a sort of a bitter way. I think I was very lucky to be able to go into politics at the age I did, and get to the top and get so much done in a relatively short time. And you know, because I was able to have a lot of exciting adventures before I got into politics. I, you know, had lots of several careers and, you know, was able to achieve financial independence, which has always been important to me and I guess is important to most people. Lucy and I had got married relatively young, so by the time I went into politics, our children were adults. I mean, Alex wasn't even living at home. He was studying overseas. Daisy was at university. So, you know, we didn't have that, you know, that real struggle that, you know, so many politicians did, that Peter did, with small children. Federal politics is incredibly tough on families, terribly tough. You know, the spouse who is not the politician ends up much of the time being a single parent. And you know, and the higher you go up in the political hierarchy, if you become a minister, let alone a leader, you spend less and less time in your own bed. So it's a brutal, brutal business as far as families are concerned.
I want to ask you about some of the huge expectations that many people placed on you becoming leader and the sort of warmth that many Australians had towards you who weren't necessarily from the Liberal Party or Liberal Party supporters, and what it was like carrying those expectations. And then as you reflect on that at the end of your political career, the extent to which you feel like you did or didn't fulfil that expectation.
You know, people will often project onto a leader, their own expectations, many of which may be quite unable to be realised, you know. One of the greatest assets in politics is low expectations, because then you're not going to disappoint. In terms of, there were sort of three big iconic issues that were I've been associated with, my critics, but the people on the right were concerned that I was associated with them, and the people on the left were concerned that I wasn't doing enough about them. And they were the Republic, same-sex marriage, or the legalisation of same-sex marriage, and climate change. As far as the Republic was concerned and is concerned, you know, my view, and Tim, of course, was, you know, fellow foot soldier in the Republican cause, is the same as it has been for 20 years, which is basically that the next big opportunity for us is when the Queen's reign ends. I'd love to think I was wrong, but I honestly have seen nothing to suggest that's not the case. As far as gay marriage is concerned, well, we got it legalised. You know, it was, as is often the case in politics, a complicated road. But, you know, I read things where people say, oh, Malcolm abandoned his principles because he went along with the plebiscite. I mean, a plebiscite, a parliamentary vote. I mean, these are questions of process. Our own system of government has a mixture of direct democracy through referendums and parliamentary democracy. I'm not keen on direct democracy, to be quite frank with you. I've never liked it for a whole range of reasons we can get into if you like. But presented with the realities, the political realities, the important thing is to get the outcome. And we did. So as far as marriage equality is concerned, that box was definitely ticked. On energy, you know, I got a lot of good things done there, particularly the move to storage and pumped hydro and Snowy 2, Battery of the Nation. I mean, these are the big, energy storage, projects and agendas which will make renewables reliable. There's no doubt about that. I do, as I say in the book, I've done the state some service. I would have liked to have done it more, but I don't feel the realistic expectations should have been disappointed, put it that way.
Do you think that the push for Religious Discrimination Act, a positive religious freedom, is because the Christian majority once had the power in Australia, feels with secularisation, maybe multiculturalism, it doesn't have the power. And where do you stand on a positive religious freedom article?
Look, I thought, at the time we were getting marriage equality legislated, there was a lot of, there was a huge amount of angst from some of the church groups that had strenuously opposed it and their supporters. And so I agreed to commission Philip Ruddock to undertake that review. And Philip's conclusion basically was that religious freedom didn't need to be, Australia, religious freedom was not under threat. So, Philip produced a report that I expected him to, not because he had those expectations were laid upon him, but because I knew he was an intelligent, experienced person who would come to that type of conclusion. You've got to be very careful what you wish for, Tim. Religious freedom is absolutely fundamental, but also we live in a society, the foundation of which is mutual respect. We are the most successful multicultural society in the world. That is built upon, I believe, on mutual respect, and the problem is it's very easy to say, yes, I support religious freedom, but then when you get into specific cases, you get problems. I mean, what if you have, as we're talking about schools earlier, you have a school and a father turns up to the school, let's say it's a state school, and says, it offends my religion that my daughter is in the same class as boys. There must be separate classes for boys and girls. Well, the school would say, that's ridiculous. If you want to find a school that will accommodate your wishes, free to do so, but we're sort of not going to change our operations simply to suit your particular, concerns.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and Tim Costello and I are speaking with Malcolm Turnbull, 29th Prime Minister of Australia and author of A Bigger Picture, his autobiography that's out now. Malcolm Turnbull is concerned about right-wing populism being confused with conservatism. He says right-wing populists have no consistent or considered political philosophy. So I asked him to define a conservative. This was his response.
Oh, well, a conservative, I would say, a conservative is somebody who believes in the organic nature of society, as I described earlier, being connected to the past and the future. So in other words, and what I mean by that is you respect and honour the traditions and institutions from the past and then seek to preserve the best in them as they change and evolve to serve the generations to come. And so conservatism is really a sort of a pragmatism. I mean, and it's not, conservative is often seen nowadays as a sort of right wing. But, the Labor Party, the British Labor Party, and indeed the Australian Labor Party, the whole principle of Fabianism was all about, evolutionary change, and you know that's the classic definition of conservatism. I'm just looking around. I haven't got it at to hand here, but there's a great line in Quentin Hogg's book, The Case for Conservatism, where he says we conservatives embrace change, but do so building on the rich subsoil of, you know, British political culture, or you know, I'm no longer doing him any justice.
What's gone before?
Yeah, correct. That's right.
Roy Williams wrote a book about the faith of Australian prime ministers a few years ago. You came after that book. But in terms of religion and faith, I mean, you had a mixed experience growing up. I think when you were young, your mother dabbled briefly in theosophy and you say alarmingly in Christian Science, but that was brief. And then your dad had some kind of Presbyterian connections. You became Catholic significantly through your wife, Lucy. But you talk about faith as a bit of a mystery, don't you? Is that largely how you talk about it?
Yeah, I do. So my mother had always told me that I had been baptised as a Presbyterian. When I say always told me, at some point I was told that I'd been baptised as a Presbyterian in the Ebenezer Chapel, which was built in 1809 and is the oldest extant church building in Australia. My Turnbull forebears, you know, had a hand in building that, and many of them are still there, you know, under the sod in the graveyard. And there's actually quite a few Turnbulls living in the district, you know, scampering around on top of it. I sort of learnt in the, sometime in the 1990s, that in fact I had never been baptised, as it happened. So what I'd said to the, I'd misrepresented my true affiliation to the vicar Cumnor, quite innocently. And I had was developing quite an interest in theology at the time. And so I didn't convert to Catholicism. I was actually sort of received into the Catholic Church ab initio, really. And that's when I became a Catholic. I remain a believer. I have struggled in recent years in my relationship with the Catholic Church, you know, in large part, frankly, because of the child sexual abuse issue, but there are, you know, other issues as well. But that in particular, you know, I've got a number of priests I know that are, saintly is not the right word, but are, you know, thoroughly Christians, if you know what I mean. But I'm not, I do struggle to reconcile that sort of humble Christianity with the indifference of the hierarchy to those who should have been, you know, should have had the greatest protection. That's probably a summary of where I am. But I love the Eucharist. I mean, I love the symbolism, the mystery of the Eucharist, which I think in a way the Greek Orthodox, I think probably do better than the Western Christians do nowadays. It's a much longer services, which obviously tries the patience of the impatient. I think they better capture the mystery, perhaps, than the more modern liturgy does.
Yeah, and the mystery is an interesting part, crucial part of this, right? You mentioned you had some interest in theology, and has that become more important to you, or as you've gotten older?
I haven't read any theological works for a long time. I got quite interested in it about, 20 plus years ago. And I didn't deal with this issue in my book because, to be honest, as you could probably gather from this discussion, my thinking on it is perhaps, I wouldn't say it's undeveloped, but it's underdeveloped. So that might have to be the subject of another book when I have the time, to reflect more deeply. But mystery is the right word. And, you spend a bit of time in politics, I tell you, it just reminds you all the time of that wisdom of that great great old bush saying. I'm not sure whether it really is a bush saying, but that Linton Crosby said to me many, many, many years ago. He said, when your neighbour starts quoting the Bible, start counting your cattle.
Depends who your neighbour is.
Correct, yeah, exactly.
The connection, the segue, I guess, is a lot of religious evangelicals in America have been Trump's base. You dealt with Trump, stared him down on Obama's refugee deal. If you were prime minister now, how would you be handling his inconsistency, his America first isolationism? Seems to be a retreat from traditional US global leadership. How should Australia be handling this?
Look, the truth is, you know, you've got to play the hand of cards you dealt, right? So the important thing in dealing with Trump is not to allow yourself to be bullied. Don't fall for the 3P trick of thinking that you'll be loved or let alone respected by being a sycophant. That is absolutely the worst thing to do. You've got to, do what's right, stand your ground, defend your own interests, but do so in a respectful way. There's no point being rude to people or gratuitous, but equally, you've got to stand up for your own position, you know, which I did on a number of issues, not just the Obama or the deal I had done with Obama on refugees, but on trade and other matters. What I've just said sounds like absolute common sense, doesn't it? Sounds like a penetrating glimpse of the obvious, as Lucy's dad would say. But it is it really is something that has eluded a lot of Australian leaders, you know, and a lot of world leaders generally. They get to Washington, they get dazzled by the, you know, the pomp and circumstance and the power of the imperial capital, and they become echo chambers for the, for the imperial leader. And this has happened throughout history. You know, when various barbarians would turn up at Rome or Constantinople, they would be dazzled and by the imperial court and become suitably compliant. And that was the whole purpose of having imperial courts, of course. But you've just got to keep your head about you and make sure that you defend your own interests. And you know, you've got to recognise, I never had any problem making it very clear that the agenda Trump was running, particularly on trade, was quite contrary to our interests. And so, you know, when I describe all this in the book, but when I kept the Trans-Pacific Partnership alive, which was a fairly solitary cause, by the way, you know, to be at the outset, I mean, everyone said the deal is dead, Trump's out of it, it's finished. You know, I was ridiculed in some quarters. I mean, Trump's idea of having, you know, no multilateral trade agreements, just doing bilateral deals, I don't think that's a good policy for America, by the way, but it certainly isn't any good for us. And so so that's why I stuck with that. And there were leaders, other countries, that thought this might offend Trump, but I, you know, managed to persuade them that wasn't the case. And, you know, we kept the deal alive, and it's, you know, it's up and operating. And, you know, thank heavens we did. I mean, you know, in this, can you imagine, particularly in this this COVID and hopefully soon post-COVID era, which I think is going to encourage protectionism, getting a deal like the TPP done would be very, very hard, you know, if you were to start from scratch. I don't know that you could get it done, frankly.
Well, do you have any reflections on this COVID period and how we've gone as a community in kind of dealing with it and some of the life changes that it seems to have thrown up at us?
Well, Simon, I think you've got to say we've handled it better in Australia than most places. I think based on, you know, incomplete research on my part, I would say the only countries that would have, you know, markedly done better with it than us would be, say, Taiwan and South Korea. But you know, and I'm going to say I'm including Australia and New Zealand together because we've reactions have been fairly similar. I think Australians have by and large respected what the governments have asked them to do. I mean, often it seemed to be a bit incoherent and inconsistent, but you know, if someone's in uncharted waters, you can't expect you know, them not to be chopping and changing and adjusting, you know, course. So I think we've done pretty well. I think the challenge of getting out of it and what happens next is going to make the epidemiological challenge of dealing with the pandemic look pretty straightforward. You know, I think our biggest challenges are ahead of us. And, you know, one of the things we've got to remember is that the proposition that we're all in this together, yeah, that's true up to, that's, you know, up to a point, Lord Copper, but because, frankly, the people that have been hardest hit by this are younger people, people on lower incomes, people in, I mean, the industries that have been hardest hit are the ones which have very high levels of female employment, very high levels of casualisation. And some of those sectors are going to take a very long time to come back. So there's I think it's a huge amount of changes, but we're going to have to, I think, carefully monitor as the economy sort of comes back to life. It hasn't obviously died, but as it revives, we're going to have to be very careful about monitoring where it is recovering and where it is not, and making sure that we're providing the support, the safety net, especially in those areas that are, you know, that are not recovering and in some cases may not recover.
Any political writer writing their autobiography will look back on their career and point to highlights. We asked Malcolm Turnbull about the things he's most proud of. Interestingly, one of the things he pointed to was what he described as a leadership model that was built on collaboration and restoring traditional cabinet government, even though he says collaboration was not reciprocated in the way he was ousted from the role.
I really do believe in collective leadership. And I know, you know, a lot of people say, you know, that I've got a very high opinion of my own opinions. I do have a high opinion of my own opinions, but I've always believed my opinions are improved, advanced by listening to others and you know, basically picking other people's brains, which is why I've, you know, for years used to wander, go to meetings with notebooks and then latterly iPads. That political culture, that cultural change that I was able to make, I think was very important. And it would get criticised sometimes by people in the press who would say, oh, you know, he's indecisive. Where's the indecision? What they're complaining about is you didn't make a spur of the moment decision, you know, make every decision from the flying from the seat of your pants. You know, there's a lot of merit in looking at issues very carefully, considering all the options, listening to people's opinions, thinking about it, and then making a decision. You know, the person that thinks they, you know everything or have got the instant answer. And of course, in politics, there is a real tendency in this, you know, increasingly media-driven environment to be looking for the decision that gives you the media hit. But very often, you know, it gives you literally 5 minutes of sunshine, because then all of the problems and follow-up and implementation, etc., descend on you. So you're better off working these things out carefully and collegiately.
And then lastly, what's next for Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I've got some ideas, some more literary, you know, creative projects, probably in the area of energy initially and politics. I'm very interested in this problem of populism, of right-wing populism. I think it's a huge, that and its interaction with the media, the, you know, the decline of the curated media, the rise of this situation where everyone can, you know, basically subscribe to their, not just their own, not just to opinions that agree with theirs, but to facts that agree with theirs. This is, you know, that's a longer discussion on another occasion, perhaps. But also, from a business point of view, I'm very active again, investing in Australian technology and innovation, which is one of my great passions.
And maybe return to your reading of theology.
Maybe you two can inspire me to do this, but maybe we could collaborate. But here's the proposition. Yep. Now, you've probably heard me talk about this publicly. We are living at a time of the most advanced technology, you know, in human history. You know, we have technologies that we take for granted now that were the stuff of science fiction only a few decades ago. And yet, isn't it remarkable that in many parts of the world, and Tim spent a lot of time there in the Middle East, in the subcontinent, even in our own region, you've got places where people for hundreds, if not thousands of years, had lived together more or less amicably and harmoniously, despite having different ethnic religious backgrounds. You know, if you think about the multi-religious Middle East, which was certainly, you could have spoken about, described 100 years ago, gone. You know, the Constantinople or Istanbul, you know, is no longer the polyglot, multi-religious, multicultural city it was, let alone cities like Smyrna or Alexandria. And then, you know, you work right, you know, look at those ancient Christian communities in the Middle East. They've been smashed, caught between the Shia anvil and the Sunni hammer. And, you know, and then you look at the persecution of Christians in parts of the subcontinent, particularly in Pakistan. Look at the persecution of Muslims in India. You know, the expulsion of 1 million Rohingyas from Myanmar. Then these are people that have, you know, lived there for hundreds of years. So why is it that with all of our sophistication and technology, in so many parts of the world, we are less tolerant than we were a century ago? And that's a question that to which I don't have the answer. And I'd really love to. That's something I should turn my mind to, I think. But I've got to say, it underlined why we must not take for granted our achievement in Australia. You know, because while all of this is going on here, we are more multicultural, more multi-everything, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, you know, than before. And yet we live together with a remarkable degree of harmony, despite political and media elements doing their best to unpick it and aggravate it.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart, and Tim Costello. Big thank you to Malcolm Turnbull today for being so generous with his time. His book that's out now, A Bigger Picture, is really a fascinating read. It's published by Hardy Grant. At CPX, we're working hard to contribute to a positive conversation about faith, meaning, the things that matter. Everything we do here at CPX seeks to do that, and we can only do it because of supporters who donate to us. Every bit counts. Go to lifeandfaithpodcast.com to find out more. Next week.
I think what she might want to say to the extroverts, it's worth having some time away from the people. It can feel like we're just on a conveyor belt of activity. And so there's never really the space to confront our soul or really assess whether this is the best way to be using our time. For the introverts, she might be wanting to encourage them to take some risks. Whatever that looks like, and it doesn't have to be interacting with the King of Spain. People are making a difference in the world all the time in very small ways.